all smile. Good morning.
Welcome.
Our purpose, of course, is well known, and that's to spread broadcast the teachings of Theosophy as found, as recorded, in the writings of H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge. And it should be noted that the policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of Theosophy, without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the Theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it to time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of Theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a true realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among Theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim and purpose and teaching, therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers. The sole bond between its associates being that basis, and it aims to disseminate this idea among Theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as Theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race or creed or sex, condition or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true Theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. We advise that you pick up one of these wonderful little yellow pamphlets before you leave, if you have not done so already. And you will note on the bottom a little paragraph. Being in sympathy with the purposes of this lodge as set forth in its declaration, which we just heard, I hereby record my desire to be enrolled as an associate. It being understood that such association calls for no obligation on my part, other than that which I myself determine. And we see a list of lodges listed on the bottom here. Now, as you noticed, we opened at 10:30 this morning and began properly at 11. And this being November the 26th, the topic today will be memory of past lives. On Wednesdays, the door opens at 5:15 so that you may come in and peruse our library and its books. Speak to a volunteer who's in charge there and find out what the topic for the Wednesday night will be. Now the library closes at 7:15, allowing you 15 minutes before the class begins in this room. You will find a book table as you come into this room where you may purchase straight-line theosophical documents and books and pamphlets and talk to that volunteer. At the present time, on Wednesday, the study class begins at 7:30 and over at 8:30, and the topic will be taken from that wonderful little book, The Ocean of Theosophy by William Q. Judge. Everybody's welcome to attend. And I repeat, this is a wonderful little pamphlet to stick in your pocket or your pocketbook and carry around with you. Usually before the topic this morning is taken up, there's a reading. And these readings are somewhat different, as they are taken from the text for children. And the book is called The Eternal Verities. Now then, listen. Never was I not. Never was I not. Never, never shall I cease to be. Never the Spirit was born. The Spirit shall cease to be never. Never was the time I was not. End and beginning of dreams. No conscious thing beneath the sky will ever cease to be. Unending, all as thou and I. Though forms change constantly, the life imprisoned in dull earth may bloom in lovely flowers, so all evolve a fairer birth when law brings forth the hour. And on through endless reach of time, through forms from stone to man, as up a ladder beings climb, this is the perfect plan. The masters, men, perfected are. And we may also climb to starry heights and worlds afar, and know the truth sublime, remembering ever that thou art. The way will shorter grow, and true brotherhood within thy heart, though thou shalt reach to those who know. Reach to those who know. Our topic this morning, for your information, memory of past lives.
Thank you. Those verses from a children's book, short and sweet, offering a picture of what can be, illustrates that regardless of our age, 3, 4, 5 years old, 95, 100 years old, there's an unshakable sense and a potential search all around us. This unshakable sense of the eternal I is there despite changing conditions of age, despite illnesses, infirmity, accident, sleep, and dreaming. It's there. And that unshakable sense of the eternal is also in existence among those who find themselves in hospice care, or those who have a terminal disease where they can't quite wrap their minds around the fact that this incarnation is ending, because they have a sense of I am and I'm going to continue on. We look around the society and we see people who profess to have a deja vu experience, or they dream. And in those dreams, they can recite memories, and they're trying to figure out which life is that. Is it a past life? Is it this incarnation in the past? Is it fancy? What is it? And we know there are those in the popular culture who use artificial means, hypnosis, psychics, etc., because they're seeking age regression. They're seeking a source of information, channeling or whatever, because they're curious about past lives. If we look around society as well, we know that that search is in the realm of science, it's in the realm of religion, it's in the realm of philosophy. we're reminded, and perhaps you would like to question or discuss Ian Stevenson's research, Life After Life. There is a Dr. Tucker in Virginia who has researched life before life. There are books available, like A Little Boy Named Jimmy Leidinger. The book was called Soul Survivor, the memoir of a tiny child who came into this incarnation full of confidence that he had been a World War II pilot. We know in terms of the theosophical movement, the work of H.P. Blavatsky and William Q. Judge, much of their straight-line presentation of theosophy was based on the duty of bringing the lost chord of Christianity, reincarnation, back into the public mind for consideration. And certainly in our reference library, on the book table, on the internet, you can do your own research. There are fabulous textbooks available. Cranston and Head's book on reincarnation. There's a smaller book called Scope of Reincarnation, which is great. And just too many to count anecdotes of recall in tiny children, especially in the East. Those of us that may have relatives who are just beginning to seek information about past lives know that there's a little girl, a tiny British girl named Alma right now, who is appearing on TV shows. She is a musical prodigy. She sings in an operatic voice. She plays the violin. She plays the piano. She has composed symphonies and operas. Her parents are amateur musicians, but at 2 and 3 years old, the amazing talents that came out of this child are very apparent now, and she's aging a little bit. She's not 10 yet, but that kind of an example of where does genius come from? Certainly that kind of full-blown genius in one life in this tiny child doesn't seem to make much sense. So you may have folks in the public who are beginning to question on the basis of something like that. For the student of theosophy, there is so much study that's available, so many things that you can explore when you think about where are these past memories? Where are the memories of past lives? You can look at religious philosophies, poetry, myths, legends, symbols. You can look at intellectual histories, and certainly throughout the research of Cranston and Head, there are many examples, biographical examples of modern people who have stated what they feel about their past lives. But the true nature of self, this eternal sense of I am that, I am soul of a deific essence, that true nature of self is shared by every single human being on this plane. We can all observe the experiences and the writings of others, but then the question arises frequently in these rooms among seekers for truth is, well, how can we find memory of past lives? And the student of theosophy replies, and for what purposes would you seek that information? So, having said that, What is there about human nature that allows for memories of past lives? Well, the philosophy presents a statement that we are, as the spiritual sun, we are this deific essence, and our lower personality, our memories, our experiences, our reflections through matter of that ray of the eternal. and that we can rest assured, in the same way that we may have just experienced the Thanksgiving cycle, we know we've done that for decades upon decades. Do we remember all of the Thanksgivings and all of the details? No. Do we come forward in time with a knowledge or an internal wisdom of what Thanksgiving could be or should be or might be? Yes. And in that same way, we have to remember that as soul beings, as mind beings, as deific essence, we are using brains and physicalities that are very limited. They're temporary in nature. And therefore, even while in this incarnation we may struggle with recall, remembrance, reason, logic, and we know that there's this electromagnetic aspect to the physicality that we're using in our bodies, we still know that beyond the physical, beyond the limits of what the physical brain can do, there is soul in varying degrees, and it is possible that through right living, through a dedication to the seeking of truth, we can build a sense of vehicles that can be used to express soul wisdom, full buddhi manas, what we would call in the philosophy. Key to the search for truth, then, is to live mindfully, to register cause and effect in our daily lives, and to try to maintain a life's meditation. Because as we reflect on any single day led, as we begin to practice trying to concentrate in the moment and to live in the moment, we begin to be able to express soul insight, soul wisdom through the physical. And in that way, through dreams and visions and creative pondering meditation, we have a potential to unlock mysteries of who am I, why am I, where am I going, and how am I going to get that there. That intuitive sense of wisdom will come from within. So, as beginners, why would we want to remember past lives? Most of us, as seekers, trying to fit ourselves to be the better able to help and teach others, to serve all of life, know that we've got a tremendous array of past causes in this particular incarnation to try to make sense of the experiences that we have had, that we are having, and trying to figure out how to practice life as both a scientist of life and an artist of life. It's in that daily practice of trying to understand our tendencies, trying to figure out how can I develop a character for right living, trying to understand how do I best serve another? How do I empower another to help themselves? Therein is the magic of past lives to be found, memories to be found in what would be called the mundane. All we have to do is dust off any moment and we begin to think about it, to experiment with behaviors and values and ethics, and therefore transmute all of life, don't we? So, as we move through daily life, some of us practice morning meditation with a devotional book, setting a tone for the day. Some of us try really hard to be mindful during the day, or maybe even set up periodic periods during the day to stop and take an assessment of how we're using life's force. Some of us journal to try to make a record of tendencies of the personality, tendencies of the biome, the body itself. Some of us sit for evening meditation for a longer period of time and try to reflect on what tone did I set for the day and how did the day go? Where did emotion color thinking? Where did the personal color the principle, the ideal of oneness, of universality? And in those processes, however it is that you as a student come to this pursuit of self-knowledge and a definition of service, what you find is individual and collective levels of habits, affinities and predilections, talents, interests, childhood training will come back, and all of a sudden we begin to think, wait a minute, there's a value or there's a custom that may be decades old, but does it still make sense? It's something I took on artificially. Is it something that I want to maintain? Fear and repulsion is another arena where these tendencies from the past, earlier in this incarnation and perhaps skandhas from eons ago, all come to fruition, and they're there as a painter's palette, if you will. They're there to be used, to be looked at, and to be considered. Now, that can be done by the individual student, but collectively, when we come together as a family circle or a circle of chosen friends that we now know are our family, if we come into the workplace, wherever that may be, or a room like this one, where there's a collective, we can begin to see interchanges among and between, and there's an opportunity to say, gee, what are tendencies like? What kind of chemistry might have been in past lives or earlier in this incarnation? How can I begin to think about this and use it in a new way? On the truly greater level, in terms of national, you could do an individual study of the 1500-year cycle of civilizations. And in that study, you can find tendencies where the Romans and the Egyptians seem to be very similar to modern Americans. And you may have ideas about that. There seems to be across time a pattern, an average, of souls incarnating together, echoing what was before, building on what was before, and maybe changing the angle just a tad bit, if you will. By looking at yourself and your own tendencies, your own nature, your own skandhas, by looking at a group with whom you find great affinity, looking at those tendencies and impressions of life, by looking at larger groups across time, those ways, those mechanisms are experiences and explorations over the duration of time that allow for more and more insight, more and more wisdom or intuition to arise. And it is said that across duration, across the lives, with a sincere, altruistic effort to understand the nature of life, the nature of human beings, to understand deity as the source of all, periodicity, cause and effect, or karma and reincarnation as the why and how things are brought about, evolution, and our role in propelling all of great nature to higher and higher levels. All of those considerations will gradually create scenarios in which we help one another to purify substance at all levels, and in turn to open up, to make porous the most dense physical substance available to us, so that across time, memories of past lives will naturally stream back in a format ethically where they empower an altruistic service to everyone else, not through passive hypnosis or listening to somebody else's trance, but rather in a very natural unfolding of what was, what is, what will be in a combination, if you will, a celebration of the moment. So as you heard from the children's reading at the beginning, it's important to remember the childhood verses, remembering ever that thou art. The way will shorter grow, true brotherhood within thy heart. Thou reach to those who know. And it is said the great masters truly do know everything there is to know about the universe and all memory of past lives. Now, hopefully you came to the room this morning with plenty of observations of your own. There's a fast hand.
Is there any explanation for why children are so apt to remember their past lives and then forget after they reach a certain age? They're much more likely than adults to keep that memory. The memory seems to fade.
Well, if we consider the pre-existence of the soul coming out of the past incarnation, that soul is just coming in to use the matter and substance at hand. And because that soul is so close to the devachanic state and may have set up causes in the past where there's this impassioned desire along a particular line, that soul in the very young child may have a far clearer recall of something that's happened before. And there are all sorts of anecdotes. It is said that the closer a child gets to seven, the more apt that those memories are to be lost. And if you think about it, you sometimes can observe parents a little bit rattled about something their child is saying. The toddler may be saying, "When I was a baby, I saw these airplanes doing X, Y, and Z." Well, if the parent is not open to discussion with the child and poo-poos it or shuts it down, the child is going to forget more rapidly. There was an example in 1994 in Ireland. I'm pretty sure that you can still search it online. People magazine picked up the story about a woman named Jenny Cockell, who was such a tiny child, who from the beginning of her life, her incarnation in Ireland, was talking about another house and the fact that there were eight children in that house. And she had to leave them too soon. And she used to draw pictures of things on the walls and all sorts of objects. Well, flash forward as an adult, she was allowed to maintain those memories. Her parents didn't block them. The people at school didn't poo-poo them. She was just left to brood about this. Eventually, what happened was she did her own research following maps that she envisioned through childhood and whatnot. And she found a family in the town where she thought she would find them, where a young mother named Mary Sutton had died, leaving all these kids as orphans. And this woman then pursued the children, not so much that she would again be the mother, but more to put those children back together because they'd been split up in orphanages and foster homes and whatnot. Yeah.
I don't know if it was 60 Minutes, but some magazine-type program like that did a follow-up film on that family. And like most of the children said, "Oh, yeah, that's my mother." But it's very funny because you have this young woman and these 60-year-old children. And it was just charming.
Yeah. And again, the issue, because Jenny's incarnation started like 21 or 25 years after the death of Mary's incarnation. So is this definitely incarnation? Is this someone that came in with intuition and could follow the astral and knew for whatever reason that these kids needed help reuniting? We don't know. But there are plenty of examples of this. Yeah.
In those examples, is it so much that the memories are lost or they're obscured by the memories we have of this life? Because we think we all can acknowledge that the majority of our everyday awareness is taken up with the memory of all the pleasant and unpleasant experiences we have now in this life. And if that preoccupies us, there's no room to remember it.
Yeah, mind, what's the saying that mind takes the shape of what it's contemplating? And we know that, you know, think about when you first become aware of existence in the morning, there's a kind of a sense of existence, but it doesn't have a limiting effect. It doesn't have attributes. It's not person X. It's not a list of to-dos for the day or anxieties of some nature about business or family or whatever. And then gradually, as we let go of the original I am, all these other mental activities and mental constructs begin to define us and contain us and distract us. And it's effort, isn't it, to maintain meditation or to focus to say, you know what, I'm really about this particular habit formation, or I have this thing that I want to pursue that's spiritual. I want to understand that. We know in the course of any one day that distractibility. So we can only imagine on a broader scale what happens as we come into a new incarnation. Yeah.
We remember the phrase, "Suffer little children to come unto me and forbid them not. Such is the kingdom of heaven." How do we interpret that?
Well, it's, you know, suffer the little children to come on to me and to consider the kingdom of heaven. That's an interesting study all of its own. Looking at the major world religions, Islam, Judaism, Christianity, Hinduism, Buddhism, Sikhism, the kingdom of heaven is always taught to be something within. Not a place, someplace up in the far recesses of the universe, not in the starry sky, but rather the kingdom of heaven is within. So if we don't distract children from the spiritual wisdom of I am soul, I can turn within and find a conscience, an intuition of how to use the golden rule of how to lead an ethical life, or maybe to use art or music or poetry or some kind of recollection of what they're to do and duty. If we allow children to be, they have far more potential to pursue the spiritual line of thinking, and therefore far more potential to meet the karma of past lives that rises up. And isn't, in many ways, the karma that rises up, the effects of our past action, the experiences, the friction between new people, isn't that the memory of past lives? Yeah.
What is it about small children that the philosophy says that they come, you know, if they die at a very early age, like an infant or a toddler, that they come back quicker?
Well, if you think about a person who has hit the age of conscience, a child who is self-conscious around the age of 7, a child around the age of 14 who's beginning to explore emotions and the chamic nature, somebody who's lived 21 years and is now past the student age and just beginning a professional duty of some sort. Each of those individuals have had the opportunity as soul to make choices, to look at a karmic condition, react to it, and then go ahead and set up a new set of causes. And those decisions are based in an ability to practice metacognition, to be self-aware. A child who has not yet reasoned, who hasn't had that full incarnation of Buddhi Manas overshining their physicality, an infant, a toddler, they don't have the same set of ethical causations to work with. Their desires may be very limited and may be very simple, maybe pure compared to what they would be as older. And therefore, if there's no karma established, then their after-death states, Kamaloka, is certainly going to be a lot faster. And their devachanic aspirations will be very simplistic, if anything. So there would be a tendency to reincarnate quick. Yeah.
We have an interesting example of this. We have a younger cousin who was always known to have her imaginary friend, and she would have discussions with her imaginary friend on whether or not to climb on the table or whether or not to go out when she's not allowed to. And she always blamed her problems on her friend. It was never she who did it. And this is at a time, I was also a child, but I was well older than her. And then I came to theosophy and started learning about this. And the name of her imaginary friend was Manas.
Was what?
Manas.
Oh. Manas?
Yes. She had her discussions with Manas. And then eventually I started chit-chatting with her about theosophy, and forget it. It's just not there in her adult life. In her adult life. But she has other priorities. She's got kids and all this. We'll see what happens. Who's to say?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah. Very interesting. I have a brother-in-law who never wet his pants. It was always Peter down the street that did it. Yes.
Okay. So if the memories of our past lives are not stored in our brain, but in Buddhi Manas, or that part of Manas that's permanent, what role does intuition and spiritual discernment in us play in trying to regain the memory of those lives?
The philosophy offers us something to consider, that there is a principle or a force of spiritualized action, spiritualized ideation, and that collectivity, that heritage, is so that as mind beings, as we work our way through the human state and we generate experience and we generate inspirational ideals and principles with which to work, all of that ideation is, it's not lost. Thoughts are things. The same way that our brains work on electromagnetics that I don't understand but I know exist, the same way we can test brain waves, we know that there is this font of information that's available. Well, if we can train ourselves up, if we can offer to a small child the opportunity to practice right thinking, to use logic from the correct premises, to explore the universality, you know, so-and-so slapped me at preschool. What did I ever do to him? Well, if we can help a child turn that around and say, what might be going on with the person who slapped? What can you see as a possibility that you could help with? as we begin to hone our use of emotions and thinking and the brain and our physicality, what happens generally is all of that substance is transmuted, it's impressed, it's uplifted, it's made more porous. And so in states of deep sleep, in states of meditation, in moments of clear seeing, intuition, just a moment in time where we suddenly have a full-blown sense, this is the right thing to do. All of us have experienced the impulse of, wow, this is a person I could help in exactly this way to help themselves. Where's that coming from? That's the intuition, that wise insight, where we tap into that Buddhi essence, that heart essence of what it is to be human. And we see it in times of horrible catastrophes, where just John Q. Smith on the street suddenly turns into a superhero and helps any number of other folks. That Buddhi essence wells right up and comes to the fore and invigorates life. Did that speak to where you wanted to go? Or?
Remember an old expression a student used to use, that in any moment we have the ability to remember and choose the better for the dearer. And that better comes to us through intuition and discernment, but so often we either ignore it or forget it, and by inclination or habit just listen to and follow the dearer.
And sometimes the dearer, that which is more attractive, is the easier. You know, sometimes we have to pause for a moment and say, ooh, do I really want to say that to my friend? It would be so easy to keep my mouth shut and not say anything. It would be tougher, but better to talk to heart to heart to my friend and say, gee, here's something to think about. Maybe this might help. And run the risk, perhaps, of friction or hurting the friend for the better. Tough one. And they're in the tiniest moments in life. Driving down the street, I can be polite and kindly or short-tempered and wicked. In the privacy of my own car, which is better, which is dearer, which is better for the long haul, and which is an immediate, reflexive, feel good in the moment. Yeah.
Well, I'm sitting here wondering, how can I apply this? How can I live my life with this what we've just been presented? And we keep on going back to the Gita and just being present, being 100% focused in the moment. And that your focus is really on yourself. We become the what you would call the witness, but the observer of our own actions, of our own feelings, of our everything that we do. And that this becomes the beginning of understanding the whole world. Because if we do not understand ourselves, and we do not work with a reward in view unselfishly, and we become unattached.
Mm-hmm.
Unattached. That we can walk more freely in life without these encumbrances that we have created.
The Gita is fabulous, isn't it? And how many thousands of years old is that text? I mean, human nature is timeless in a certain way. And the whole psychology, the whole practice of attempting to turn our concentration to the moment and to consider what is nearer or dearer, and maybe turn our concentration to, wow, I just said something that triggered a whole different response in this other person. What's that about? Staying in the moment with it. Not telling the story of how rotten the other person is, but rather to explore, gee, now I got a different response. What would trigger that in me? How are we alike? And that practice, which is so, so simple and yet so difficult to continue and to maintain, is where the magic of life exists. That's where body, soul, mind, spirit all comes together, and we get the opportunity not to be anxious about the future, not to be shameful or disgruntled about the past, but as was said, to remain detached, to remain neutral, calm, cool, and yet caring, because the process is the greatest gift of empathy, compassion, and caring for another that we can give. Yeah.
It was interesting you mentioned that English girl who's, she has all these talents.
Alma.
And we saw the interview and they said, you know, would you like to be remembered as as Bach? And she said, no, I want to be remembered as Alma.
The first Alma.
The first.
Yeah,
right,
the first. Yeah.
And we thought, you know, she was very, very charming young lady. But we were thinking about her talent, which is genius, absolutely, to this student, seems to be a proof of reincarnation. It doesn't spring out of nowhere. But then there's also that case in the Ocean of Theosophy about Blind Tom.
Yes.
Who, we don't know if that's also a talent coming back to, but apparently he could just mimic, he didn't actually create. And that he went off the rails at one point, he got a little full of himself and he became hard to be around. Whereas, you know, I don't know.
Well, there's degrees of genius, aren't there? Right? And ultimately speaking, if we can see partial genius in someone, if we can see what we're calling from the outside full-blown genius in the area of music, if we see glimpses of past lives and the memory of past lives in those examples, then aren't we looking at proof positive that there is greater genius potential in the human state, and that as we look across time in all cultures, in all continents, among all peoples, these stories of these great saviors or these great masters, where past, present, and future is known, and tremendous wisdom can be given out. The cases of Tiger Woods at 2 years old, I watched him putt on the Mike Douglas show, this tiny baby with this little teeny weeny golf club. That's a partial genius. Alma's another kind. Blind Tom is another degree. But if we extend that logically, what tremendous power and potential is in each and every human being? Remember the posters on the buses, a mind is a terrible thing to waste. And oh, how many lives will we waste before we wake up mind the way it needs to be? Way, way in the back.
We think we also have to take into consideration the karmic conditions. Blind Tom was a slave.
Oh, yeah.
And it's amazing that he ever had an opportunity with a piano. And Alma is born into a family where her family adore her and her talent, and obviously would do anything to help her.
And her family's affluent university professors, I mean, it's a whole different condition.
So, yeah. Yes, there's a genius lurking in each one of us, but it's lurking until we get the karmic condition, or we demand it of life, that we can ever express it.
But making that demand, is a magical responsibility in itself. We get back to the original point to the talk, which is memory of past lives. So what? Why do you want to know that? Why do you want to make demands of the conditions of your life? Why is somebody trying to concentrate so hard to create a karmic field? Why purify these skandhas? If the answer is the dearer, because this personality is really fun and should go on forever, but needs a little tinkering. If it's that personal, materialistic, self-centered kind of consideration, the motive is off the tracks. If the motive is more along the lines of, this world is so screwed up and I can't seem to do much right now, how do I go about serving the world to be a better place for each and all? If it's that kind of altruistic sense, then our motives are closer to right thinking. Yeah.
Couldn't we make an argument against...
We can always make an argument.
Couldn't we make an argument then against knowing what our past lives are? Because we think in the philosophy, the masters say that we wouldn't be able to handle some of the things that we would find out about ourselves, that at this point in our evolution, it's just not something we need or can handle. Whereas if we let it flow naturally, at some point when we do remember, we will at that point be able to handle what it was that we've done in the past.
So be careful what you wish for. Too much knowledge can really be a tough thing. And I guess the analogy that came to mind while you were speaking with the folks that are doing their family trees, and, you know, they're loving the mystery and the puzzling of it and doing the research. It appeals, you know, to anybody that likes that kind of pursuit until they find out the first ancestor that got hung for horse thievery, you know, and then it's, oh. You know, but it's the same thing. And truly, as we sit here, as this student sits here at the advanced stage of decay, there are probably... things done in this life in earlier decades where there's a blissful ignorance about how that decision horribly impacted somebody else and did something awful. Would it be helpful to have that knowledge now? Yes, if we could in a way that would do no harm, right that wrong. But is that always the case? So we can take those examples and then create the bigger picture of reincarnation. Yeah.
Just to return to the idea of genius, we don't have to be a genius to begin to think and act as if we were one. Because from everything we've heard, all that power already lies within us. So if we begin to act as if we were, that's how the ability develops.
Mm-hmm. So acting as if. So if we wake up in the morning and set a note for the day, here I am, a student, a beginner, looking into this philosophy and looking at it to see does it hold water or not. So we're really a beginner. What if I act it as if these three fundamental propositions are truth? That we are all of a deific essence from one source. Not only all soul in the human state, but all degrees of soul in all conditioning. What if we acted as if that day that was the case? What if we acted as if cause and effect might be a law? And we began to look at our motives and how we act. What if we held the premise, everything is in evolution, and it's ongoing, and it's grow or die? How might that affect our thinking and our being for the day? Way in the back.
Yeah,
The sad thing about all that's just been said is it's already true. So when we're acting as if, we are acting in harmony with what is. If we would just learn that the reciprocity, the golden rule, is the way of life. So everything we decide to act as if, we're going to get back in full measure.
But sometimes as beginners, when habit formation is really, really strong, the only way we can get ourselves off the pillow and up and going is to restart as if. And then as we explore life, we come into the fullness of the wisdom within. Yeah.
Well, do we have to begin with the idea that we're beginners? Do we have to begin with that idea that we are beginners? Are we in fact beginners?
Well, if the philosophy is correct, if in your pursuit of truth you can find evidence that there is this 1,500-year cycle of collective incarnations of people, if you can see patterns between Egypt and Rome and the United States and other places in the world, if you can see in the example of Alma or Blind Tom, or in the example of your own proclivities, your own affinities, your own talents and interests, if you can see evidence that there was life before life, that there life is and it comes and it goes, if that's the case, then we've incarnated how many times in the last 18 million years? This body, this affect state may be brand new and acting like a beginner, maybe a little blocked in some ways, but the soul is. It is eternal, ongoing, and ever in this wonderful spiritual process. Yeah.
We recall when we were younger joining the Boy Scouts, and they called us tenderfeet or tenderfoots. But after several months and years, perhaps, we became first class Boy Scouts. But that tenderfoot motto was be prepared.
Say that again, please.
The tenderfoot motto is be prepared.
Mm-hmm.
Is there something that we can glean from that idea of suffer little children to come unto me?
Well, as soul moves through stages of life, as eternal soul is and gradually gets more perception of what does it mean to be prepared, soul gradually moves through these stages, moves through these karmic conditions, until finally the state of Eagle Scout and Scout Master, etc., are achieved. But it's the same way of life in terms of babies are born to hone to their primary caregivers, eye to eye. That's the face they identify with. The truly healthy soul expression is the family that can take that identification of the face that's like mine, the face that's like the one in the mirror, and expand it across time until it's eye to eye, soul to soul, not in any way, shape, or form conditioned by what the other's physical is like, but more one-on-one, soul-to-soul, because we are one indeed. Our time's up. The study class Wednesday night will be in the Ocean of Theosophy, and next Sunday we start a whole new cycle. You'll forgive the pun. The month of December, the theme is called Cycles and Cyclic Law. And the consideration next Sunday morning will be the cycles of death and rebirth. See you then, if not Wednesday night.
good. Did you turn this off?
No, no.
Okay, wait. I got it.